This is VSiN Prime Time. Live from the Circus Sportsbook in downtown Las Vegas on VSiN, the Sports Betting Network.
Thank you, Brent Musburger. It is prime time for the next 4 hours. Matt Eumanns here at the Circus Sportsbook, downtown Vegas. Will Hill at his estate in Connecticut. And, Will, when we left the studio last night, we knew there would be an NBA Game 7. It was a blowout in Indianapolis, and the Pacers forcing a deciding seventh game for the first time since 2016. We love it. Love Game 7s. And I thought this was going to be a long series in the beginning, and now we're at the end. And we've had some movement in the market since we left the studio last night. You and I were speculating about what would the line be for Game 7. I believe I said 8 and 220. You said 8.5, and you had a lower total around, what, 216?
Yeah, I thought I said 218, 219, something like that. But they beat us to the punch. We were expecting the under to take money or to be popular, and it opened what, 214 up to 215 in some spots. So they're onto us. You always say it, edges don't last forever, and these game seven unders have been a trend, and they've certainly built that in. They accounted for the game seven trend, and plus the fact that game six was 197 total points. The under has been something that's not as well kept a secret anymore here.
Now, we got some details on that. We're going to expand on that later in the show. The market did move a tick down today, and that was from 8.5 overnight to 7.5 today. OKC now a 7.5-point favorite. Total here at Circa is 215. At some spots out there, 214, 214.5, but very consistent with the total and the line now pretty much painted 7.5 across the board. More NBA coming up, a lot of NBA talk coming up on the show tonight. But first, we have to get to baseball. And Will, a game about to start in the Bronx. Max Fried and the Yankees stopped their 6-game losing streak. And today, Fried is a big favorite again. The Baltimore Orioles roll into town. I want to see if you have a bet on this game. But the Yankees and Fried minus 325. Total of 9. If you're like me, you can't totally trust the Yankees just because they had one good day and stopped that 6-game losing streak. I can't even play the Yankees on the run line here. Could you flirt with the Baltimore Orioles at a big plus price? Yankees at minus 325, and this game starts in about 3 minutes.
Yeah, and that number has even gone up because I saw it was under $3 not that long ago. And of course, shop around, you might find a better price. I did do the square ball thing. I used the Yankees money line in a parlay with OKC for game seven, paid around like a minus 128, something like that. So not terrible. Throw these in once in a while. And one thing, these East Coast books are very quick to limit you, especially if you're doing well. If you throw in some money line parlays with some big favorites, they think you're a square. So it is, I think, important for the account of the health of the account sometimes too. But to me, I think the Yankees win. I think OKC wins in game seven here. And you know what? If the Yankees win, I put myself in a position where I can take the Pacers plus the points and I can go for a middle, but I can't lay 1.5. I can't lay minus 300, just straight up. So I know that, it's square, but I did use the Yankees in a money line parlay here. And look, the Orioles have been horrible against lefties. I think 211 batting average, 288 on base, under a 600 OPS. That's against lefties, and they're going to see one of the better ones here. You got to figure, it's a dangerous way of thinking, but some of the Yankees' offensive woes, offensive struggles, maybe they're snapping out of it. They scored a bunch of runs yesterday, hit a bunch of balls hard, hit some homers. This is a Sagano guy, the pitcher for the Orioles here, is very hittable. So I would think the Yankees, warm weather here on the East Coast, ball should be carrying out. I think this is, they're a rightful favorite, I guess is how I would put it here tonight.
You know, this number opened as low as minus 225 at some spots. At Circa this morning, at 8 o'clock this morning, minus 285, and it's all the way up to 325 now. You said Sugano is a pitcher that the Yankees should hit, but then again, Will, there were some other pitchers the Yankees should have hit during the 6-game losing streak, and they did not. How do you feel about Max Fried going into tonight? 9-2, 95 innings, 90 strikeouts, a whip under 1, 0.95, an ERA of 189. He's been really good overall this season, not the best lately.
Yeah, but look, he was pitching at a pace that was unsustainable. I think you and I were doing the game before he pitched against the Dodgers, where you and I, it was a Friday night, and you and I both kind of agreed that, look, as great as he's been, I think he had a sub-1 ERA at that point. I don't care how good you are. He's not going to sustain this. He's kind of due for a clunker. He had one against the Dodgers. We had a little bit of a hiccup. He's had got hit a little bit. I think 6 or 7 hits last time out against the Red Sox, only 2 runs. But I mean, look, you can't complain about anything Fried's giving you if you're the Yankees or a Yankee fan. He's been A+. Got a chance to be in the mix here for a Cy Young right alongside Skubal. He's been that good. So, look, the matchup against lefties, everything Fried has done, this should be a good matchup for him, at least on paper. Of course, it's baseball. He can come out and give up 3 or 4 runs in the first inning. And I look like an idiot, but good matchup here for Fried.
Well, you and I were doing the show on a Friday night 3 weeks ago, and Max Fried got roughed up by the Dodgers in L.A. 5 innings, 6 runs. He gave up 2 homers that night. He's allowed a homer in each of his past 2 starts. Even though that start in L.A. against the Dodgers, you sniffed that out. You said you thought he was due that night for a bad outing, and you nailed that in the head. Since then, he's been a lot better. It's just, man, that's a tough price to lay on the Yankees. A lot of steam on the Yankees. They win one game after losing 6 in a row, and all of a sudden the bettors are all on board with the Yankees tonight, and that game's about to get going now. That is not our top game tonight, though.
The lights are on and the stakes are high. It's the primetime game of the night.
All right, we talked to Yankees. Now we're going to talk Red Sox. How about the controversial trade that sent Rafael Devers to the San Francisco Giants? And how about timing, Will Hill? The Red Sox happen to be in San Francisco to see Rafael Devers. And tonight it's Birdsong for the Giants, Dobbins for the Red Sox. Giants minus 125, total of 7.5. Do you think Rafi Devers is going to be a little bit fired up for tonight's game?
I would think he would, and I was thinking about this. It'd be even more fun if this was in Fenway, obviously, but great drama, great excitement here with this matchup, and just very strange. I mean, I was sitting there watching the game. You know, it feels like a day or two ago. It feels like 10 minutes ago. Hits a homer against the Yankees. They sweep, and then you get the alert that he's been traded. Just very bizarre timing of it. But from the motivation standpoint, you'll have a lot of people tell you Rafi Devers is motivated. I'm going to play him to hit a homer. I'm going to play his over bases. I'm going to play pro Devers stuff. It makes sense. He's motivated. He's pissed off that they traded him, all of that stuff. But you could also take the line of thinking of nobody knows their player better than their former team. They probably have a book on him, what pitches he likes, doesn't like. And I think one thing that's kind of underrated here, you look at his splits. He's hit 294 at home this year, 249 on the road. San Francisco, that big, spacious pitcher's ballpark is a lot different than Fenway, where you could just get an outside fastball, an outside whatever, and just put your bat on it, get it in the air, and that thing's going off the wall for a double. You don't have that luxury in San Francisco. So the fact that it's much friendlier to pitchers here, and the fact that maybe the Red Sox have a little intel on Devers, what pitches he likes, doesn't like, that kind of thing, that would keep me off of it. And I didn't play it. I like, if anything, the under 4 in the first 5. I just think Birdsong's a good pitcher, pretty good stuff, sub-3 ERA, gets a lot of swings and misses. Giants, not much of an offense. You can pitch around Devers, too, if you really like, which is the problem playing those over hits, over home runs, all those over total bases. Walks don't count for that. So anything, if anything, I like the under 4 here in the first 5. How about you? Did you think about playing this game, handicapping this game?
Thought about playing the Giants, did not play it. Right now, the Red Sox, 5 games back of the Yankees, 39-37, 8-2 in the last 10. That's the thing. The Red Sox were red hot when they traded Devers, and that's what ticked off a lot of Boston fans. But 5 back of the Yankees going into tonight. The Giants hanging in the race with the Dodgers in the NL West. Giants 3.5 back. Padres 5 back there. D-backs starting to slide a little bit, 8 back. But the Giants... right now, only 3.5 back of the Yankees at 42-33. Giants were close to a bet for me today, but did not make it. I saw an interesting chart last week, Will, because I thought the same thing. When Devers went from Fenway to whatever they're calling the stadium in San Francisco now, what is it, Oracle or something like that?
I think so.
It's definitely not a hitter-friendly park, but I saw a chart of Devers' hits at Fenway and how they would have played out in the Giants' park. His average would not have been much different, surprisingly. So it looks it's not exactly doomsday for Devers going to San Francisco in that park. But that was something I did consider playing tonight. Will, quickly here before some of these other games get underway, and Max Fried's taking his final warm-up throws for the Yankees here. We have Braves, Marlins in Miami about to start. Reds, Cardinals in St. Louis. And also the White Sox, Blue Jays in Toronto. Anything else early on the card that you considered for a bet or you did bet tonight?
Sweating out right now. I gave it out earlier on VSiN. Pirates first five team total under 1.5. That is DeGrom versus the Pirates. Tough day for the Pirates, or tough couple days. You see Scooble on Thursday, DeGrom on Friday. That's a good day to that's a good time to come down with a sore ankle or a flu to avoid those two guys. As far as the games you mentioned, I thought about Atlanta. Just they might be hitting their stride at the right time. They're a much better team than Miami. I couldn't quite get there with the price. Blue Jays and White Sox, I passed. White Sox have come down to earth here. I think lost 8 in a row. They have not swung the bats at all. One homer in the last week. Singer, Pallante, in terms of Reds, Cardinals, don't love either pitcher. I could see an over there, but no plays on any of the three games you mentioned.
You and I snuck out a winner. We had to sweat out a winner on the Reds a couple of days ago. Did not want to get involved in this Reds game tonight, but here's the guest lineup for tonight's show. Jackson Holliday stepping into the batter's box to start this Orioles-Yankees game. Aaron Moore, the professor, comes up in about a half hour to talk College World Series. He's also got a sharp bet to recommend on the Major League Baseball draft. And you don't want to miss that, because I think this is a pretty good play that Aaron Moore is going to recommend at a good price, too. So the professor comes up here in about a half hour. Hour number two, Super Dave Ross. If you don't like Dave Ross, there's something wrong with you. Dave Ross is going to break down the UFC card at 5 p.m. Pacific. And Sam Chowdhury on the NBA. And hour number three, we're going to preview Game 7. We're going to talk a lot of NBA Finals Game 7 tonight. We're fired up to have a deciding seventh game in Oklahoma City on Sunday night. And final hour, the madman, the Boston Strangler, Casanova Christmasero, is on the show. And if you haven't seen his Twitter feud with JBT, you might want to catch up on it. Chris has a lot to say about the Oklahoma City Thunder. Stay tuned. BSN Primetime for 4 hours rolls on right after the break.
This is VSiN Primetime on VSiN, the sports betting network.
All right, got home last night after the show, Will Hill, and had some NFL, VSiN NFL betting guide stuff to work on. But before that, I wanted to watch the NBA replay. And I watched the replay about three times last night. I don't know about you, but when I win a bet on a game, I could watch the replay over and over and over, pick it apart, pick the film apart like a coach. And I enjoy watching it. If you lose a bet on the game, it's hard for me to watch it once. Sometimes I'll go back and watch it, but it's painful. You and I won the bet last night on the game. Watched it over and over, and I picked up a lot of things that Rick Carlisle did differently last night, some adjustments he made. And we were talking about before the series, the better coach, once you get deeper into the series, makes adjustments. And that's why the coaching advantage means so much in a long NBA series. Well, before I talk in detail about what I saw last night, did you go back and watch the tape?
I did. I'm the same way. When I lose a bet, I don't like to watch it. When I win a bet, just to give you an example, there was a replay of the Giants-Eagles game from 2010, the famous DeSean Jackson punt return game that I won a big bet on. It finished off a parlay. I sat there and watched the last 8 minutes of it. I enjoyed every second of it. Yes, I can still remember the date, where I was, all that stuff. So I'm the same way. And look, we were watching the game and watching the show. You can get a feel for the game while we're doing the show and watching at the same time. The shooting, we can make observations, but I would say, I'm curious what you feel. It's a limited feel. It's not the same as just sitting in front of the TV and focusing on it. And plus, I think once you remove yourself from having money and having an investment emotionally, financially in it, you can just observe and just kind of be neutral and observe and take things in. The thing that jumped out to me, I'm curious what you think and if you feel the same way. What jumped off the screen to me was the effort of OKC versus the effort of Indy. And it's the reason the zigzag theory, I think, is effective. You can't fake desperation.
Right.
Indy played like their season was on the line, like their season's over if they lose. OKC had a game in their pocket, and they played like it. Turnovers, loose balls, offensive rebounds, transition, all of the energy stuff, all the energy stats. Defense, all of that favored Indy. They just played harder, I thought. Now, look, you watch this and you think, man, Indy might be live in Game 7, I think. Any team is live in any game. It's a one-game series. It's a one-game season. That being said, you have to look at OKC. We've knocked them for the road performance, but the flip side of that, they've been dominant at home. They led Game 1 at home by 15 before blowing that, but they led Game 1 by 15. They led Game 2 at one point by 23, and they led game five by 18. They have been just a completely dominant force at home. And if you look at the spreads, 10.5, 11.5, and 9.5, the three home games, you're getting a bit of a discount here with the 7.5. I'm surprised it's as cheap as it is. But again, what jumped off to me was the effort of the Pacers. I thought really was much better than the OKC effort. OKC looked lethargic. They looked tight. They didn't shoot the ball well. Forget the 8 of 30 from 3. A lot of that was garbage time in the fourth quarter. OKC just didn't play that hard.
It started 1 for 16, so the 8 for 30 doesn't mean a whole lot. There was a lot of – correct. It hit some garbage threes at the end when the Pacers really weren't defending. You know, what you said about desperation in the zigzag is perfect, because I equate it to this, right? If you're in debt and you got bills to pay – you're going to grind. You're going to work like crazy to pay off your debts, to get ahead and make money, right? You're going to work your ass off. If you inherit $1 million from a family member, you're probably going to kick back, lay on the couch. You're not going to work as hard, be a little lazy. OKC showed up last night playing with house money, right? They got a one-game lead in the series. They know they can go back home in game seven. There's no desperation on the OKC side. On the Pacers side, it's live or die. And they played like a team with their lives at stake last night, and they came out and played desperate, like they had to get out of debt and tie this series. And I thought the Pacers played with what I expected, the best effort. I was talking with Mitch Moss and Paul Howard on their show the previous day, and I said, you're going to get the best shot from the Pacers here in game six, because they're off a game where they played poorly, turned it over, looked like a bunch of buffoons out there. And they've been criticized relentlessly here for the past couple days. You're going to get their best effort after they blew the Friday game, played poorly in game five. You know you're going to get the Pacers' best shot in game six with or without Halliburton. Okay, so you had that going for you if you bet the Pacers. The other thing is OKC's a immature team, a young team. They showed up, like you said, didn't play with great effort last night, knowing that they could go home and win a game seven. The other thing is Rick Carlisle made adjustments. I thought he made some great adjustments. When you watch the way the Pacers defenders were switching off screens and the way they were not allowing OKC to drive the lane, they were not allowing SGA to get into the lane like he usually does. And they were doing a lot of things to complicate the offense, the half-court offense for Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. It shows up in the box score. Well, when you look at it, SGA turned it over 8 times. The Thunder turned it over 21 times. That's atypical of the Thunder, and I think it has a lot to do with Rick Carlisle's defensive adjustments combined with how hard the Pacers were playing, and you pointed that out. It was not only adjustments, you got to give the effort too, and the Pacers gave great effort, and they had great execution of what Carlisle wanted done on the defensive end. And the result is a game that was 90-60, right? When we went almost, we were about to go off the air last night. It was a 30-point game, yeah. Total blowout. You combine all those factors, and you had a non-competitive game six. How about this thought for game seven? Do you think the Thunder might be tight, feeling the pressure because it's all riding on Game 7 and they just got blown out by the Pacers? Or do you think they'll come into it confident that they've been so good at home and they have Scott Foster on their side? By the way, a report just came out. Scott Foster will officiate Game 7 in Oklahoma City. Will, is the league sending the fixer in to save the Thunder?
I don't think so. We've talked about this before, that the league doesn't operate like they did with David Stern. And plus you got your game seven. So any conspiracy theories, why does it benefit the league that the Thunder win versus the Pacers? It's not going to affect the ratings. I mean, the Pacers, if anything, and we're not there yet, but if they win one more game, and you could talk about them, not only most unlikely NBA champion of all time among the four major sports, at least in my lifetime, I can't remember a more unlikely champion. Maybe some of those New York Giants football teams that made crazy runs, but I saw one tweet from Patrick Everson today. Somebody bet them for $1,000, 85-1. Not before the season, not in the middle of the season. April 29th, they're talking less than 2 months ago. This team's 85-1, and the NBA is a sport where you don't get upset. So I don't know that the Thunder and Foster, I don't know if there's anything there. If anything, it's just the fact that you're home and the crowd, and there's just a natural human nature element to, hey, let them be more physical. If a 50-50 call, you might call a foul. If the game's in Indy on the Thunder, you might let it go. If it's in Oklahoma City, I think that, if anything, but I don't think there's some grand conspiracy that Foster's going to fix the game for the Thunder. I don't really buy into that. Do you?
No, I don't, but I did not like the way he officiated game four in Indiana, and that was a different situation too. I thought the Thunder got a benefit of a bunch of calls there, including SGA's push-off and his four-step travel before the key bucket near the end of the game, where Foster was standing 4 feet away and had the whistle in his mouth and just stood there and watched it. That was inexcusable. That was not incompetence. That's just a guy who saw two violations and decided he was not going to blow the whistle. But that, you could say, that was a situation where they were trying to extend the series. They wanted to see OKC win that game four and extend the series because they would have been down 3-1. If you're a conspiracy theorist, that's what you would have said. I did think the Pacers got the worst of the whistle, and Foster stood there and watched. And maybe the biggest moment of the game, SGA commit a foul and a turnover, and he didn't blow the whistle. So that was fishy to me. But at the same time, why would the league care if OKC wins instead of Indiana? It's not better for the NBA if OKC wins, right? It's not worse for the league if Indiana wins. So, no, I don't necessarily think that. But you're going to have some talk about Scott Foster officiating this game because of the way he officiated game four, when he definitely gave the benefit of the doubt to the OKC Thunder side. How about the adjustments Carlisle made and the turnovers? Hey, let's hear from Shai Gilgeous-Alexander here for a minute, talking about the turnovers. He had 8 and the Thunder had 21.
Yeah, I don't even know. They just turned this over a bunch. They didn't pressure full court like they have been, which led to more turnovers. I didn't expect that, but whatever it is, they did it right. And if we want to win on Sunday, we got to take care of the ball. Moral of the story. They were definitely lower on the pickups. I'm not sure. Like some of them, I think it was just like carelessness and not being focused, not being as engaged. They played harder than us tonight as well. And when a team plays harder, they usually turn the other team over. So it's probably a combination of multiple things.
All right, well, the Pacers were dropping their defense a little bit, packing things into the lane, switching off screens at the top, not letting SGA drive the lane. It's kind of funny to watch him there talk about it because he couldn't even really explain it. But part of it is carelessness, like he said. I thought the same was true with the Pacers in Game 5, right? The Pacers were just clumsy and careless when they made 22 turnovers. Kind of the same thing with OKC last night. But what did you see when you watched Indiana defense on tape?
They played hard. They played well. And OKC doesn't have a lot of spacing. Unless Wiggins is going to be out there, there's not a lot of shooting. So it's either SGA forcing it, trying to foul bait and get to the free throw line, as it looks like the Orioles are going to take a lead here. There's not a lot of options. Holmgren is giving them nothing. Holmgren's supposed to be the third best player, giving them 11 points a game in the series, 35% from the floor. Holmgren's got to play better. Otherwise, there's just not a lot of offense here for the Thunder.
Let me tell you about Edge Boost, the first ever bank account built for bettors, ensuring all gambling transactions are approved. No usage fees, no minimums. Earn cashback rewards, 100% approval for all betting deposits. Sign up today at edgeboost.bet with promo code PRIME. Deposit $25 and Edge Boost will match the deposit. That's edgeboost.bet.
This is VSiN Primetime on VSiN, the sports betting network.
Orioles and Yankees underway in the Bronx, and the Yankees yet to get underway. The Orioles have the lead. Will Hill, give us the update.
2-0 Orioles, a base hit by the Orioles, and then two straight hit by pitches by Fried, and then a two-out single from Yankees' old buddy, Gary Sanchez, who, to be honest, I knew he was bounced around Brewers, Padres. I completely forgot he was even on the Orioles. I think he's been on the IL. But he delivers a base hit in a revenge spot. We're just talking about Devers in a revenge game versus the Giants. Well, Gary Sanchez in a revenge spot here against the Yankees delivers a two-run single. So the Yankees get out of it with further damage. They are coming to bat now. Goldschmidt leading off for the Yanks. Full count in the bottom of the first as they trail 2-0. So you don't see a full dollar move too often in Major League Baseball. From minus 220, minus 225, all the way up to a minus 325 at close. That's a hell of a line move. Not sure what predicated that. I understand people are just not don't have basketball or hockey to bet, so they're just going to bet the Yankees because they're a favorite. Orioles have struggled versus lefties, but quite the move on the Yankees so far. It doesn't look like the right move.
We came on the air and I looked at the screen at 4:01 p.m. Pacific. Yankees were -325 here at Circa. At 4:02, the Yankees went to -340. They were taking money all the way up right to the first pitch, so bettors all over the Yankees. Opened as right around 220 at some spots. Closed minus 340 here at Circa. Orioles have a 2-0 lead. Chigano is a pitcher that the Yankees should hit. But we'll see. Yankees not been hitting much lately. Total is 9. So if you bet the over, off to a pretty good start here. But Max Fried not off to a strong start tonight. Will, did you watch any of the antics last night between the Padres and the Dodgers?
I did. The basketball had concluded. There was only one or two games left. Astros, A's, and then Dodgers, Padres. Dodgers are nice here on the East Coast because there's not much else on. You can just kind of focus on them. They're a fun team to watch. And I noticed a lot of people thought it was strange that I think it was Mookie Betts and Freeman got pulled in the eighth inning in a 5-run game, which, all right, that's somewhat unusual. It's not a 10-run game, though. It'd be weird to pull those guys. Well, they brought in some pitcher I'd never heard of. He fires at Tatis. The bench is clear. Roberts and Schilt going face-to-face. So that was not one of these where you get a lot of fake fights in baseball. Nobody really wants to fight. You can sense there's real animosity, real hatred between these two teams. So it's probably right now with the Yankees and Red Sox not the rivalry it used to be. Dodgers-Padres is probably the best rivalry in baseball, but things got ugly. I don't think anybody got hurt, but Tatis thrown at, Otani thrown out the other day. That's a fierce rivalry right now between those two teams.
Well, Red Sox and Yankees, not a great rivalry right now because it's so lopsided in favor of the Red Sox.
Yeah, that's right.
They've won 5 out of 6 and just swept the Yankees at Fenway Park. I know a lot of people thought, well, the Yankees are really good this year. The Red Sox stink. Now, but Red Sox turns the tables on them, won 5 out of 6. Here's the thing. You said nobody wants to really fight in baseball, and there were no punches thrown. It looked like there was going to be a brawl, and, of course, nothing really happened last night. But Robert Suarez hit Shohei Ohtani, and Suarez said, of course, he said it was unintentional that he hit Ohtani. No pitcher ever says, yeah, I drilled him on purpose. I hit him in the shoulder, but I was trying to hit him in the face. That doesn't happen. Suarez actually got a 3-game suspension from MLB. Mike Schilt and Dave Roberts, he's got 1 game. Those suspensions were announced today. So not a whole lot of fallout from that. Nobody's going to miss the managers for 1 game or Robert Suarez, who will probably appeal. But Fernando Tatis got hit last night, and that's something to worry about. Manny Machado said, I think Tatis got hit on the wrist. Is the wrist or the arm? Well, that's replay. Couldn't tell where the ball hit. But anyway, that's one of those injuries where it breaks a bone. The guy could be out a month or two. Manny Machado said the Dodgers better pray that Tatis does not have a broken bone. Well, he doesn't. According to Annie Heilbrun, a TV host and reporter who covers the Padres, she says Tatis walked through the clubhouse this afternoon, and when he was asked how he was doing, he said, I'm good. So it sounds like Tatis x-rays came back negative, and he's not going to miss a lot of time or much time at all. And that was a big concern coming out of last night. You didn't want to see Tatis suffer a serious injury after he got hit. But, Will, I think 8 batters got hit in that series. And the downside is the Padres and Dodgers are not going to play again until August. I wish they played again next week, but we don't get to see those teams play again until August.
Now, do you – breaking this down, who do you think – do you have anyone that you would say is at fault, who started it, you know, who took it too far? Because I've been catching bits and pieces of it. I know they've been throwing at each other back and forth, but I don't know who's to blame. I know a lot of people said Roberts, you know, he's a clown, he's a punk for initiating that and then going after Schilt and then kind of running away. I have a hard time picking sides here. Can you kind of pick sides and sort out how this started and who's to blame here?
I don't know for sure who's to blame. I did question some of Dave Roberts' comments and maybe some of his tactics. So I thought that maybe Dave Roberts had something to do with it. But again, I don't blame the Padres. When you hit Tatis, go after Ohtani, a star for a star, right? An eye for an eye. If you're going to hit our star, we're going to hit your star. So I didn't have a problem. I like the fact that the Padres don't back down. And, in fact, I think the Padres probably should have started a real brawl on the field last night and sent more of a message to the Dodgers, especially if they thought the Dodgers started that thing, to say, hey, we're going to finish it. But those two teams are going to be fighting to the end in this division. But the Padres got to find a way to win more games on the field. They've won only 2 so far in the head-to-head series against the Dodgers. All right, still 2-0. Yankees actually have bases loaded and no outs, Will. So 3-1 count with it looks like Jazz Chisholm at the plate, Stanton on deck. And I believe the bases are loaded, right? Do you have the game on?
Yeah, bases loaded, 3-1 count, Chisholm at the plate. If I were a cynical person, I'd say they'll probably figure out a way to not score here. But as you know, I'm not a cynical person. So I have full faith that the Yankees will come through. And Chisholm lines one to left. It falls. So the Yankees are going to get on the board here And it looks like just the one run is going to score. The runner on second, Grisham had to wait to see if it was going to be caught, which it was. And so base is still loaded, 2-1. Oh, boy, if you bet the over, you're off to a good start here.
Aaron Boone chewing gum. He's confident.
Yes.
And the Yankees have cut the lead to 2-1 with Stanton coming to the plate. The base is still loaded. Yankees actually ran the bases well that time, Will. They didn't run into a dumb out or make a mistake there. You could not send the runner home with Stanton coming up and no outs. So 2-1. If you bet the over in this game in the Bronx, you're feeling pretty good about the way things are going right now. A little bit better about the Yankees bet, too, because they should score at least three in this inning with bases loaded, no outs, and one in. All right, back to the NBA here for a minute. So you and I were talking about this before the break. I thought the Pacers dropped their defense down. They were switching off screens. They weren't allowing Shai Gilgeous-Alexander to drive the lane last night. He had 8 turnovers, only 2 assists. He did have 21 points. He's going to get his points. He'll find ways. He'll get to the free throw line. But the Pacers, much better defensively. Also, I thought OKC just careless, right? They were didn't really bring it last night. You mentioned they didn't bring the desperation. They didn't bring the attitude that you need to close out a series on the road, and the Pacers did everything they could to stay alive last night. How do you think things shift? Are you thinking about things a little bit differently as it goes to Game 7? Do you say the Thunder have been so good at home throughout the playoffs that the Thunder is probably going to win Game 7? We're going to talk more in depth about the history of Game 7s in the NBA, but there's not a lot of trends pointing to the Pacers on Sunday night.
I like OKC. I think it's a little cheap at 7.5, like I mentioned. The first three games in OKC, it's what, 10.5, 11.5, and 9.5. And those are games that the Thunder all led at one point by 15, 18, and 23, you know, respectively. And now you're laying 7.5. That being said, I mean, how can you watch this Pacers team and all of the magic and all of the, you know, coaching, everything that this magic carpet ride, the comebacks, everything that is entailed, how could you lay points against the Pacers and feel great about it? That being said, if I had to take it or lay it, I would lay it. I think OKC, I don't know, I think Indy probably keeps the game close for three and a half quarters, and OKC eventually pulls away. They'll let them be more aggressive at home defensively. They'll probably get away with more, you know, hand checking. SGA will probably shoot, you know, 18 free throws. And I think OKC will, this will be a neck and neck game. Maybe they're a little tight early and they pull away and win by, you know, 10, 12, 14, something like that. So far the money has been on the Pacers. If you want to know where the money's really going, unlike other sources, our betting splits come straight from Circa and DraftKings Sportsbook, giving you insight into where the sharp action is landing. Circa is known for taking big bets from professional bettors, while DraftKings provides a broader market perspective. That means you're getting the real action, not just public money, but the kind of wagers that moves line. See the percentage of bets versus percentage of handle on every game across every major sport, helping you make smarter, more informed bets. Get VSiN's exclusive betting splits for as little as $9.99 for your first month at VSiN.com/subscribe. So, yeah, I think it's a little cheap. I could see OKC, who's had extreme splits home versus road here, playing much better at home here on Sunday.
I'll tell you one prop I was thinking about, and you just mentioned it. I'd like to bet Shai Gilgeous-Alexander over his free throw attempts on Sunday night. I think the Thunder are going to be making a lot of trips to the free throw line, and he'll be making the most of any player in that Sunday night game. I got more to say about the Pacers-Thunder Game 7 matchup later in the show. Right now, we got to take a break. Yankees still have bases loaded, but one out. Giancarlo Stanton struck out. That's bad news. Jason Dominguez at the plate for the Yankees, down one. Bottom of the first. Quick break. We come back. The professor talks college baseball and MLB draft.
This is VSiN Primetime on VSiN, the sports betting network.
All right. He loves college baseball. VSiN contributor Aaron Moore, the professor, back on the network tonight to preview the championship series in Omaha. Let's go out to the Progressive guest line right now and welcome in the professor. Coastal Carolina and LSU, game one Saturday. LSU -150, total of 8.5. Aaron Moore, can you just get us up to speed on your observations of what's gone down in Omaha to this point, and how do you think these teams match up in the best of three?
So first of all, Matt, it is a great matchup. You have the team in Coastal Carolina that we've talked about during the tournament, probably, and therefore right now, the best team outside of the Power Four. So from that standpoint, Coastal Carolina, 26-game winning streak, very impressive. And then you've got LSU that we talked about out of the SEC. Which one of those teams, the top four or five, were going to emerge? LSU did. So what I think the really important part to look at game one is that pitching matchup. You have Cam Flukey, the young right-hander for Coastal Carolina, going against Cade Anderson, the big lefty for LSU. In a way, it's almost like it's the World Series and you have one Cy Young Award winner going against another one. And then in game two for Coastal Carolina, you're going to have Jacob Morrison. It's almost like they have another Cy Young Award winner. So as much as we want to talk about Cinderella and underdog, Coastal Carolina is legit. They are a very good team. Absolutely, they could pull off the upset and beat the SEC team, LSU. But still, I had LSU at the start of the season. I'm sticking with them.
All right, let's talk about the first game and then the second game on Sunday and how the pitching matches up and what you might recommend as a bet. Coastal Carolina, not really a Cinderella. This is a former College World Series champ within the last 10 years. LSU, the defending champs, and a great matchup here. But how do the pitching matchups work out in your estimation? Is there a bet you would recommend on the total or the side in game one or game two, Saturday and Sunday?
Yeah, I want to look at the total because so much of what we've talked about in Omaha at Charles Schwab Field is to take the under because the field just plays big and the players during the regular season aren't accustomed to a stadium that size. Boy, 8.5, I can't play that pre-flop. I want to play the under because in game one you have Flukey versus Anderson, two top-line pitchers. Really hard to play under 8.5. I think it would be interesting. That's an in-play proposition in terms of what happens early on because 8.5 is a pretty low number. But at the same time, you have these pitchers. I don't really want to bet the over as well. So it's the line, the bookmakers did a great job with that 8.5 line. I'm going to stay away from that. Maybe in-game you might see something that happens in terms of some early runs. Maybe the early runs push that total up higher than they should be over the course of the game. So I'm going to play the over possibly in terms of what happens in game one in game action.
Aaron, you're betting this stuff pretty regularly. I know Circa has started to put up batter props in terms of home runs. Do you play anything? Do they offer more here with a College World Series championship on the line? You know, yes, no run, first inning, pitcher props, hitter props. Are there any other markets, or is it pretty much just straight up where you see these odds, side total, that kind of thing?
Yeah, well, DraftKings is starting to expand their board, almost like what we would expect with college basketball. But a lot of these player props are yes only. So they're one-sided props. And in that case, I'm not going to play one-sided yes-only props. But I do think there is an evolution of betting college baseball. As you said, Will, more and more props are being offered. The menu is getting a little bit deeper. So in terms of, let's say, just home runs, that's always what we look at with baseball first in terms of player props. It's going to be hard for a player to hit a home run, particularly LSU's Jared Jones. He's their big thumper. He hit one the other day. Still, there have not been a lot of home runs in Omaha. And if it's a one-sided yes-only board, I tend to stay away from that. Now, maybe next year and the year following that, I do think the popularity of college baseball is going to increase the amount of props that we expect for a lot of sports. They're going to be there soon for college baseball.
How about this series? Is this a situation where the longer it goes, it favors one team over another? Would you give the pitching depth? I know Coastal Carolina's got three pretty good guys from what everyone says. Does it favor one team or another depending on how long this goes if we get a third game?
If there's a third game, then it really does, I think, give Coastal Carolina a really good chance because Coastal Carolina is going with their top pitcher, Jacob Morrison. He's going in game two, so he can stay on regular rest. And Coastal Carolina has a very good third pitcher, Riley Eichhoff. What was going to happen with LSU in a third game? They might do a bullpen game, mix and match a lot of guys. If it goes to a third game, very likely Coastal Carolina is going to have the better starting pitcher. But still, I think one of the big issues for Coastal Carolina, this team does not hit home runs. They put a lot of their runs together by stringing together hits, hit by pitch, moving runners along. So they really manufacture a lot of runs. But if you have LSU's top two pitchers, Cade Anderson and Anthony Ianson, they might make it very difficult to even have base runners for Coastal Carolina. So the pitching matchup top two As good as Coastal Carolina's pitchers are, the top two are going to be LSU. Now, that third game, if it does happen, Riley Eichhoff is going to give the Chanticleers a chance.
Aaron Moore, sports media professor at Rider University, VSIN contributor, and breaking down the College World Series. Coastal Carolina won this in 2016. LSU actually won it in 2023. Tennessee won it a year ago. How about futures, Aaron? What do you have in your pocket? What position are you taking into the finals here? How high did Coastal Carolina get on the odds board, on the futures board this season?
As high as they got, they probably were at least over 50 to 1, I would guess. As the tournament field started to shape up, they were in that 20 range or so, 20 to 25 range. And it just keeps obviously getting down, and now they're the last two. And it's interesting, I think, from an odds perspective of Coastal Carolina, and I'll even admit it, this was a problem for me as a handicapper. We just didn't give them enough respect because they're not in the Power Four. They're not in the SEC. But what we've seen from this team, and particularly look at their leadoff hitter, switch hitter, catcher, Caden Bodine. They are a legit team with that pitching. So I'm going to say I was wrong, and I think a lot of other handicappers were wrong, Matt, that we should have looked at that 20 to 1 or whatever it was and higher and say, geez, this team is legit, because obviously they showed us they are.
Will Hill, we were talking about the Orioles and the Yankees. I'm watching Jackson Holliday here, and that kind of leads us, it's a segue to a bet that Aaron Moore is going to talk about here that I think is a pretty sharp bet.
Yeah, Aaron, yeah, man. How many of these holidays are there?
Go ahead.
There's a lot of holidays.
I was going to say, Will, go ahead and take it. Set them up.
There's a lot of holidays, right? And we've had his father, Matt Holliday, and now Jackson Holliday is in Baltimore. I think you're going to expect Ethan Holliday in Washington. And if you look at the boards now, they started to post the first pick for the MLB draft. And you can get Ethan Holliday minus 145. I've even seen as low as minus 110. I think this is a fantastic bet that you need to make. You need to do it with a little urgency here because it was just posted, and I don't think it got a lot of attention in terms of the College World Series and certainly Major League Baseball. Ethan Holliday has been prompted up the last 2 years to be the number one pick in this year's draft. So we've heard about him the last couple years. Obviously, Will, as we're talking about the pedigree of the family. And I think if you look at who has the top pick, Washington. And when was Washington's greatest period as a franchise is when they took that top golden boy, number one pick, Bryce Harper. He certainly helped them. So I think if you look at what Washington is in position to do is to take a high school superstar that they can build their franchise around over the next 10 years or so. He really fits the mold in terms of marketing as well. And it's interesting. There are, as we talk about Cade Anderson as one, there's really good pitching arms in college that could be the number one pick, but there's certain aspect of Ethan Holliday of what he can bring to a franchise. I just don't see a Cade Anderson or Liam Doyle, as good as they are, jumpstarting that Washington franchise from day one. And I think Ethan Holliday can do that. And it is interesting with his brother in Baltimore, that certain Baltimore Washington rivalry. It just brings a lot to Washington in terms of baseball on and off the field.
Matt Holliday's kids and Ethan Holliday, I believe you said you can still find minus 110 on Holliday to be the number one pick, right?
Yeah, minus 110 at DraftKings. I just think, Matt, that there's so many other things going on that this number is out there. And if you look at it, he's been talked about for so long. Mm-hmm. And when I handicap draft bets, you often look at a team gets painted into a corner by media coverage that the fans right now for Washington can say, hey, we can get Ethan Holliday. This is who I want. I want to buy the jerseys. I want to get tickets for the next decade or so. So in a way, I think already Washington's painted into a corner. They have to take Holliday.
Yeah, I've got a screenshot here of DraftKings board shows Holliday minus 110. Our graphic on the screen shows minus 145. I just want to clarify that. You could bet that at minus 110 on Ethan Holliday to be the top pick. Aaron Moore, the professor, appreciate the time tonight. Thanks.
Thanks, guys. Good luck to you.
Thanks, Aaron.